What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's Resistance in Residence artist is multi-hyphenated artist, actor, poet, playwright, painter, Biko Eisen Martin. Biko, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Biko, I want to start with a little bit about you and specifically where and how you grew up. What was your family like?
I grew up in Frisco. It was lovely growing up. You know, gentrification hadn't fully wrapped its tentacles around the Mission or Bernal or Hunters Point or Fillmore, any of these kind of neighborhoods I used to orbit. But yeah, you know, single parent household, very political mom. Shout out to my mother, Arlene Eisen. And it was me, her, and my brother. And that was it. So very, very small family, a very radical family. And, you know, I could go on for days about growing up. I mean, I'm not sure exactly, where to start.
Well, let me help you out, because I know a little bit about your mother.
Okay.
We worked together just a little bit. Talk about being raised with those radical politics, with an organizer, activist, for a parent.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, one thing I'm always thankful for is it's just an armor that I wish all kids had, you know. Because a lot of things that I think some of us internalize, I had the armor to not internalize, you know, so I could feel when things were unfair. I had a language for when I was being discriminated against or picked on, or just not, you know, not being given the freedom that a young white child might be given. You know, I had a language to understand that. I also had to a language to understand all the addicts I've seen, all the homelessness I saw, the violence I saw, all the, you know, problems in the city that, you know, in San Francisco are always right in front of your face. But I had a different kind of language to describe these problems that wasn't about blaming the people going through it or blaming the person that you see homeless or blaming the young woman that you see selling her body to survive or blaming the young brother you see on the corner trying to make a living. I had a more specific and sophisticated lens to see these things through than why are they just doing that? You know, I understood that these problems that I was seeing were stemming from bigger systemic issues. And likewise, I knew, you know, when I didn't see myself playing with the dragons on TV or, you know, winning all the wars and flying, you know, with Superman, you know, and having a young cape, you know, for the young black kids or whatever it might be. And I knew that we were actually superheroes, but they just didn't want to show that, you know, and that, you know, so while some of my peers might have grown up wanting to be something else or somewhere else, I knew that I was where it was at and that the problem that the world had with me wasn't my fault, you know. So that's, I think, beautiful. That's very important, you know, that I wish more kids had, you know, just that kind of early fortification, and just being given the gift of critical thinking, you know?
Yeah, I see that very much in my daughter, the boundaries she sets, the confidence she walks with, the way she can dismantle a situation, you know, with political analysis and point out white supremacy and its tentacles, to use the word that you just used, is amazing to me. And question for you, because for her, sometimes it's also the flip side, right? Because it was always the organizing, always the activism, which came with all of the horror stories, right? Which came with her being tear gassed at an early age, which came with her also being, you know what I mean? Like, it was nonstop pain and trauma. Now it's resisting that, right? And building models and programs and pathways to get out from underneath the boot of white supremacy, but still, like, from, you know, the time that she understood anything, she understood that we were in a fight. And she's talked sometimes about the weight of that. I'm wondering if that's something you ever felt.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I will say, you know, yes, it is a ongoing physical and mental struggle that doesn't go away. And that sometimes can be very isolating. And sometimes you do want to kind of just let your conscience down, for a lack of a better word, and just enjoy yourself, you know, or be part of a crowd. But it's very difficult because being complacent, you know, when you've been raised a certain way, really does go against the grain, you know, and to kind of, but there's no place that you can be free of contradictions.
Right.
Right. And that's why we love art so much, because at least we get to sit in the contradictions and we get to scream them out and we get to deal with them and have a space to try to process them, you know, whereas, you know, walking alone in your daily life or you know, and even in a space like a theater, you know, where you walk in and people are thinking they're having some kind of new age political discussion, when in actuality, they're just starting to have conversations that people were having back in the 40s, you know? So it can be a little difficult and you can feel a little isolated, but I mean, better that than just being a clone.
Agreed. Well, let's talk about the arts. Both you and your brother, incredibly talented and accomplished artists. You engage in several forms of artistic craft. Which did you discover first?
Wow. You know, it's hard to say. I think it's all really just like saying yes to your inclinations, you know? So what did I discover first? I don't even know. I really couldn't even tell you. You know, I would say hip hop discovered me. I would say like some of the earliest performing and, you know, professional type performing I can remember was rapping and dancing and things of that nature with my school. We used to go to other schools and perform. So even though that wasn't like professional in terms of I was getting paid, I was an artist on the road. You know, that was doing a job that a lot of people my age weren't doing as efficient or definitely wasn't as prolific in the performing of whatever the craft was. I mean, so that's where a lot of the public performing started. And, you know, my elementary school used to also do carnival. Mm. And so we'd be rapping, we'd be singing, we'd be dancing. We also used to have to perform poems. You know, we would memorize Langston Hughes poems and perform them for the school once a month. That was just part of our, you know, curriculum. So all of those things were happening at an early age. I mean, in terms of like really getting out to the world, poetry was the thing I would say that kind of introduced me to the world and introduced me as to the Bay in a way that, you know, some people in the Bay Area still even know me to this day, was just doing the poetry in high school, you know, and traveling a lot, doing a lot of performing in high school, nationally and internationally. And then I found theater also in high school, but I didn't commit to it. I really didn't know what it meant to commit to it. You know, I had a teacher who was very encouraging of me, but I was so into basketball and so into my poetry that I really just didn't give it the attention it deserved. Or I, you know, so that the theater stuff kind of came later. I was teaching high school at Berkeley High, and I was feeling myself need a transition, not necessarily out of teaching, just out of kind of where I was at in life. It was actually more kind of personal problems I was having. And going back to the theater or going to the theater was really just a way of getting some oxygen and a form of self-care and just trying to find something that was fun that could maybe put some joy in my life. And then in doing it, it just automatically turned into like a very professional kind of thing, I guess. I mean, instantly my mentor kind of identified me as somebody with special talent and got me gigs, and that got me enrolled back in grad school. And so I spent my last year teaching. I did about five plays that year, and then I went back to grad school. So that's when the theater came in. And of course, in doing theater and being a poet, then it was, plays started coming out, because I'm reading so many plays, I'm performing in so many plays. So naturally my mind starts pumping out these stories, which now, which turns into its own practice. And then the painting came after my father passed away, who was a painter. And when he passed away, I picked up some supplies, and it kind of started as an almost ancestral practice. It was an ancestral practice, but similar to the theater, I just kind of got identified by some people as someone with a special talent, and some people poured into me, and I got little tips here and there. And next thing I'm doing Tongo's book covers, and I'm getting asked to paint things here and there, and I'm getting a little shine on Instagram or whatever, and these folks want me to come paint a mural in Clarion Alley, and it just kind of builds from there, So ultimately, and that's why I think all of it is really just saying yes to yourself. You see a vision of yourself expressing something, and you can either say yes to that and make it happen, or you can come up with a reason why you shouldn't pursue it, So, I mean, it's just trying to say yes as much as possible. And even in the times where I've said no, it's never too late to circle back and be like, oh, hold on, maybe I can pull that off. Let me give that a little more time,
I do know. I do know that conversation very well. I'm looking at the paintings on your website. They're beautiful. I had no idea that you also painted. These are stunning. I said, I'm looking at the one you did of your brother too. BicoEisenMartin.com is where you can go to see some of those paintings. Well, the theater is my church. And has been since I was 8 years old. So I want to sit there for a little while. Talk about, I'm trying to think if I want to talk about acting or playwriting. Well, let's start with playwriting. If you were to talk about your work, right? If you were going to give me a log line about your work, what would
it,
it
I mean, about it's so funny because I was so anti-log line for so long.
Me too. I hate them. I actually hate them. I don't even know why I
I
use
have them
that.
for my plays,
Yep.
but it turns out
They're
now I got to
awful.
do it for my whole practice now.
Yeah,
Like,
your whole practice.
I mean, one thing I always say is just like my elders are better than yours. So that's like one. I love how much beautiful radical history I can pull from out of my own circle. So that, I know that's, and I not only do I feel like it's an obligation and a responsibility, but it's also like a privilege and super fun just to be kind of surrounded by some elders who can tell some really great stories, which haven't found their way on stages in America as much, So I feel like a big part of what I want to do is bring some of those stories to the forefront, these revolutionary stories, who are these people who really set out to change the world? Where did they come from? What end up happening to them, and happening to us, So I would say a lot of the playwriting kind of comes from a place of wanting change myself, wanting revolutionary change myself. And so kind of exploring people and scenarios where that kind of movement can be discussed and be at the forefront of conversation. So it's not necessarily a cultural conversation, it's not necessarily a political conversation with action, but it's without action, it's a conversation about movements, how do we make them happen? How do and what are our deepest kind of human realities within these movements? Because again, what makes it theater and what makes it beautiful theater is when we really get to see those conflicts live and direct, whether people can work them out or not before our eyes. That's that's one thing, but we definitely get to go home and we get to talk about it and try to work it out for ourselves for the rest of our lives. If it's a good piece of art that really gets us to thinking, you know? So I think that's really, I mean, my goal is just to really get people dreaming about revolution, get people dreaming about freedom, you know? Dreaming about unity, you know, dreaming about, you know, the one thing, you know, growing up revolutionary, we didn't mention, you know, we talked about some of the negative stuff. Another beautiful thing that comes with it is the amount of solidarity you feel for people and for strangers and the amount of empathy, you know. So it's always difficult for me, you know, like when I would be in school, you know, and going to private schools, you know, I'm identifying every person of color as my family. And you know, where see a lot of them not they're not seeing it like that, you know. But yeah, so I think also just kind of broadcasting that family. I think, you know, I forget who it was that said, you know, the job of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible, you know, and I think part of that is also just to show how beautiful our family is, you know, this kind of ever-evolving, multi-generational, you know, multilingual family we got, and how great it is, you
Beautifully complicated, I often
beautifully
say about our people.
complicated, you know, and those complications also deserve a reckoning, you know.
That's
So
right.
it's not, you know, because we aren't perfect, you know, and I think, you know, again, the art gives us to a chance to explore where we're weak at and where we're wrong at, you know, and where we need to step it up a little bit, you know.
Speaking of beautifully complicated and not perfect and human and flawed, those are some of the themes and threads in your play, Pac and Biggie Are Dead, which is running in Oakland at BAM House on Broadway from June 7th to the 30th. Without giving up too much, because we want butts in the seats, how would you describe what the piece is about? I'm really interested to hear what you say to this. For transparency, y'all, I'm actually in the piece. How would you describe this piece?
How would I describe it? You know, again, see, and this is gonna sound like a cop out, right? But it's like I'm an artist. I wouldn't describe anything. You know, I'd rather be interested in to see how everybody else describes it. You know, but no, you know, I would just well, one, it is a tribute, you know. It's a tribute to them and it's a tribute to their mothers, for sure. It's also, I think, a chance for them and us to just to hold up a mirror for a second. You know, without giving too much away, we know Pac and Biggie in this play have a lot of things they're trying to figure out about themselves. And I think in figuring those things out about themselves, who they are, why they're here, that we can maybe start thinking about some of that for ourselves as well. What are we giving? What has been given to us? You know, and how much control do we have over these kind of things? You know, the play has evolved a lot. There used to be a lot more history, a lot more hip hop history in the play. But some of that has it's kind of evolved into really trying to focus more on just the impact of these two artists. I always say the impact that they had on the world and the impact that the world has on them. You know, and one of my favorite parts of the play is when, you know, Biggie has a line where he says, "Man, they're not gonna let us go." You know, and he's found himself in this paradigm of his own creation, as we all do, you know. And I think often when we hear these podcasts with Biggie and Pac, well, they shouldn't have went this, they shouldn't have did this, oh, they should have went left when they went right, and he should have did, you know. But regardless of what you think they should have done, I think everyone agrees that they're in a paradigm somewhat of their own making, as we all are. So, like, how do we explore these paradigms, escape from these paradigms? How do we go deeper into these paradigms and how do we explode them? And then I think the most important thing is to also, I don't even want to say reimagine them. I want to just say present them as the brothers that they were. You know, Tupac and Biggie were friends and brothers and comrades and colleagues for a lot longer than they were at odds with each other.
Right.
But that's the majority of the story we see. So I just love this story where you get to see them as brothers from start to finish. You know, and maybe that's giving away some of the play too. But you know, it's not a biopic, so you're not coming to see the history of these two people from start to finish, although it does have some of their history in it. But it's them really, you know, it's an existential crisis that they're in, and they have to figure out, you know, how to get out of this purgatorial space they're in, and they have to do it together. They will do it together. You know, or they won't do it together, but they are together, you know, which I think is also just super essential. And I wish more things in our canon, you know, presented them as the brothers that they were, you know. God, I could keep out. Now I want to keep going. Cause I'm like, I know what the play is about. Let me know. It's about a lot of things. And, you know,
so also, much.
It's also, you know, and just for all the people who don't care for anything that we're talking about, you know, it's also a theatrical celebration. It is, yes, a celebration of Shakespeare, of Molière, of just what we typically would understand the Western theatric canon to be. And it's also placing our two legends in that canon where they haven't been before. You know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead is the play that it's immediately based off of. And that play is actually based on Hamlet. So, and there's another play called Waiting for Godot, which is also a very famous existential play about two guys who are kind of at a loss for what's going on, and they're trying to figure it out, and they're waiting for Godot, right? So it's a, so those plays are also influencing this play and kind of giving a baseline of where we're starting, although we kind of go some places that those plays don't go.
There's so many layers. There's so many layers.
It is also a play in progress. You know, this will be the second performance of it, but this play has not been published. It's still in development. You know, this version is a lot meaner and leaner than the version that went up in Philly with Theater and the X a few years ago. And I'm sure as I see this production, I'll learn some more stuff about the piece, which will then be infused into the piece. So, you know, it's still a piece under construction. You know, we're still developing. You know, I love the August Wilson model of kind of touring a play and working on a play for years before you try to really finalize it and put it in the books as a finished piece, you know.
I am a classically trained actress. I discovered Shakespeare at the age of 8, Molière and French farce. Some of my favorite work to do, and it has just been such a joy to watch you put our icons right in inside of that work. The I don't want to give up too much either, but Pac and Biggie sitting with words of Hamlet. there's some really beautiful things there, but you do tug on this thread that I think we've been having, right, in the world of theater that continues, and that is around Shakespeare and racism and accessibility to our people. And I'm just wondering, like, from your own life and engagement with classical works as a Black artist, what has that journey been like for you?
Oh, God. So let me give you a few. So first, I mean, you're like, in terms of our play, who better to say the words "to be or not to be,"
right?
Than Tupac or Biggie,
right? Listen, it's beautiful.
Who better to deliver that monologue? So that's first and foremost. Second of all, I would just say that, like, let me start here, right? So what Shakespeare is to the English language, whether you like it or not, so many words were invented in these plays, so many phrases, so many insults, so many. You know, I mean, I can't think of any now, of course, but literally, you know, if you Google words that Shakespeare invented, phrases, terms, ideas that Shakespeare invented, it almost seems like to not know Shakespeare, it's too influential on the English language that it's a piece of your literacy, thus it's a piece of power. So it's almost like I want to equate it to like speaking Arabic but never knowing the Quran or the Bible's influence on Western culture as well. You know, it's just such a heavy piece of language. And in unlocking that language, your literacy just goes up automatically. So to not have that exposure, it's not just like that you don't know Shakespeare, but it's an actual tool that you don't have. And it's power. You know, there's so much power in literacy. So, you know, and as we know from why we weren't allowed to read, and when we're finally allowed to read, why it's so hard to get decent books in our school. And there's such a proactive, you know, the banning of books now. There's such a proactive, I don't know how ignorance became proactive, but apparently it is. I'm trying to find the word for like, what does it mean when ignorance is taking on a life of its own and it's like propagating itself, right? I don't know what Shakespeare probably has a word for it though, and that's part of my point. And if not a word, maybe a way of a turn of phrase. I think even a turn of phrase is probably a Shakespearean phrase, right? So I just think there's power there. There's a power in literacy that I feel like we need if we speak English. You know, if you're speaking English, it just does not hurt to have that in your toolbox. I also think a lot of the way that Shakespeare has been interpreted and the way it turns people off is because it's just been done by old white men.
Right.
So a lot of things that people think are akin to Shakespeare are just actually akin to an old white man's opinion. Right. Like, for instance, one of the reasons why we do Shakespeare, right, is because he teaches us how to act on the word, right?
Yeah.
Acting 101. Shakespeare doesn't lie. And when he does lie, the character will tell you that they're lying. They'll have a whole speech about how they just lied, right?
Right.
So for acting classes, we love it because the student can just fully play out whatever emotion they're speaking on. It's not like a check off or something like that where it's like, oh, maybe I said something, but I mean something else. But when you see it, how these plays are interpreted, there's so many things that have been given to us as like, oh, this is how it has to be. But it actually isn't in the language, which means that it's not true. You know, for instance, Romeo and Juliet, it's always the prettiest boy in the school and it's always the prettiest girl in the school. There is nothing in the text that says either of those people are attractive. They're attractive to each other. You have a play like Taming of the Shrew. Shakespeare will tell you Bianca is the prettiest woman in Padua, right? That's in the text. All the guys want her. She's the prettiest. It's in the language. There's actually nothing in the language talking about. Only Romeo sees her that way, and she sees Romeo that way. But all of a sudden, they always have to be these like sparkling, beautiful people. So whose concept is that, that only these sparkling, beautiful people get to play the object of each other's affection, get to be these people in love, right? So that's a Western interpretation on Shakespeare, but that's not ever what Shakespeare actually said. Even in a play like Taming of the Shrew, where Bianca is the good sister and Kate is the bad sister, and they'll say, oh, well, Kate is unattractive. But there's actually nothing in the text that says she's unattractive. It just says she has an attitude. In fact, the person who loves her says, oh, no, she's the prettiest Kate in Christendom, which would actually let you know she's just looks just as good as her sister. Perhaps she just has this bad attitude, you know. And even I'm sorry for abbreviating with this looking good and bad. Of course, these are all with very Western standards in mind. And excuse me kind of clipping that point because we can go into all day about who decides what's good, you know, but I'm abbreviating. I think you know what I mean. You know, the blonder it is, the more blue the eye, the more like Cindy Crawford it looks, the more like, you know, whoever, you know, whatever man it looks like. That's the model of beauty. But there are so many times when that's pushed upon us when that's actually not in the text. Right. So then now we got a whole group of people who have felt alienated, and they say F Shakespeare, when really they should be saying F all those old white dudes who did it before and can only see it this one way.
Real quick, Biko, folks want to learn more about you, your work. Where should they go?
They should go to B as in boy, IKO, E as in Edward, I, S as in Sam, E as in Edward, N as in Nancy, MARTIN, Martin.com, BicoEisenMartin.com. It's all there.
It is all there. It's a beautiful website. Y'all have been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, and this is Resistance in Residence. We profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's Resistance in Residence guest is multi-hyphenated artist, actor, poet, playwright, painter, Biko Eisen Martin. Biko, thank you so much for joining
Thank
us.
you so much. And I'll see you on stage.
Yes, you will. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.